Today's reading is from Daniel chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all of the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews who you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then King Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted him and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. This is the word of the Lord.
How do you live faithfully in a faithless world? It's one thing to act faithfully when, as a Christian, when you're living with other Christians, when those around you believe the same things that you believe, when those around you live like you live and have the same values and the same morals and the same lifestyle. But how do you live faithfully when you live and work with people who aren't Christian, with people who don't believe in God, or believe in a different God, or who have different values and different morals? How do you live faithfully as a faithful Christian at those times? How do you not just cave in and compromise and go along with the culture? Well, the book of Daniel is written to help us. The book of Daniel is set in the 6th century BC. The great empire of the day is Babylon, and the great king is Nebuchadnezzar. And King Nebuchadnezzar has taken Daniel and his three friends from Judah into Babylon. They were talented and gifted teenage boys. And Nebuchadnezzar brought them into Babylon along with other teenage boys from other countries he'd conquered in order to train them at his university, assimilate them to his culture, and employ them in his civil service so that the Babylonian Empire might be maintained and grow. And so Daniel and his friends, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, find themselves in exile in a foreign land, in a multicultural, multi-faith, multi-ethnic city, working with and alongside people who do not believe in the same God that they believe and do not live like they live. How do they stay faithful? How do we stay faithful? Well, what's needed is courage. And in this wonderfully written story, we see a wonderful example of courage from these three young men as their feet literally are held to a fiery furnace. And this chapter is written not just to inspire us, but to empower us to live courageous lives, faithful lives in a faithless world. Like any good story, this chapter contains three parts. We see a fiery furnace, we see a symbolic statue, a fiery furnace, and a divine deliverer. Symbolic statue, fiery furnace, and a divine deliverer. First of all, we see a symbolic statue. We're introduced to the statue in verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and its breadth, 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Jura in the province of Babylon. Now, this statue is massive. It's 90 foot high, 9 foot wide. Think, perhaps, the Christ the Redeemer statue in Rio de Janeiro. It's a similar kind of size. It's gold-plated. This is serious bling, which would glitter in the sun. And why is it built? Well, it's built as a symbol. It's built as a symbol of power and unity. It's not an image of a Babylonian god. I don't think it's an image of King Nebuchadnezzar himself. It's an image that embodied the spirit and the power of Babylon. It's an image that would say to everybody, far and wide, look how great Babylon is. Like its predecessor, the Tower of Babel. You know, aren't you proud to be a Babylonian? This is an image that just shows the world just how great a nation, an empire we actually are. Don't you love Babylon? It's a focus of pride. It's a focus of unity. Babylon was a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-faith empire. People had their own gods who they worshipped privately. But publicly, what united everybody? What is it that we're all proud of? Well, it's Babylon. That's where our allegiance goes. That's number one in our affections. You know, we don't want to stop people having their own private faith. You can worship who you want and live how you like privately. In fact, that's part of the rich tapestry of our community. But publicly, our allegiance is for Babylon. Publicly, you need to live and act like a Babylonian. Isn't that just like Manchester life today? You know, it's fine for you to believe in Jesus and for you to believe the Bible and do what you like privately, but keep your views to yourself. You know, it's fine for you to think that certain things are right and certain things are wrong. It's fine for you to think that lying is wrong or swearing is wrong or heavy drinking is wrong or crude jokes are wrong. But if everybody else at work or everybody else in your friendship group or everyone else in your neighborhood is doing those sorts of things, you stand out as different if you don't go along with it. You're not Mancunian. You're not Babylonian. And there can be strong pressure to compromise and go along with the culture. We see here this pressure from authority. In verse 4, we're told this is a command from the king himself. You know, you're commanded to join in and compromise. This pressure from conformity. You know, in verse 7, we're told that all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped. You're going to stand out as different? Everyone else is doing it. There's pressure from intimidation. You know, just in case people had second thoughts about whether they'd join in, King Nebuchadnezzar says, well, there's this burning fiery furnace. And let's be honest, the thought of a painful death does help focus your mind. There'll be consequences if you don't join in with everyone else. Now, if you stand back for a moment at this chapter, and particularly these first seven verses, and look at it in the cold light of day, it's ridiculous what's actually going on. You know, this chapter is written with great sarcasm. It's one of the most sarcastic chapters in the whole Bible. That's why you have repetition of phrases, repetition of people and music. And the fact that King Nebuchadnezzar, what did he do with the statue? Set it up. Why? Because the whole thing's a set-up job. It's ridiculous. It's silly. People are gathering together to worship a silly golden pillar. But when you are faced with a glitzy, engaging party and everybody else is joining in, it can be hard to resist the pressure of compromise. See, living in Babylon or living in Manchester is a challenge to any believer who wants to live faithfully. And if you want to live as a faithful Christian, you need to resist the desire to compromise, because the first commandment says, you shall have no other gods before me. God comes first in the affections and priorities of a Christian, not Babylon or Manchester or anything else. But to live like that, To live faithfully like that takes courage. And so what does a courageous response look like? Well, in verses 8 to 18, we're introduced to a fiery furnace and a faithful response. We've introduced the three young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We've come across them before in chapter 1. And they're faced with a burning, fiery furnace. This is a painful death. And yet they respond with courage. And what does a courageous response look like? Well, first of all, a courageous response means that you're faithful in your conduct. Verse 8, therefore at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, some of the civil servants, they'd probably been jealous of the promotion of these foreigners, these Jews who'd been promoted to have authority over the province of Babylon alongside Daniel. And they reported them to Nebuchadnezzar. See, these men hadn't joined in with the worship of the statue, the worship of Babylon, but they hadn't kicked up a fuss about it. They hadn't gone on parade and made some placards. They just quietly stayed at home. And they'd been dobbed in. But after being dobbed in, and after being misrepresented by these guys, they again don't badmouth these guys. They don't have a go back at them. They don't defend themselves against their opponents, even though I think they had some right to do that. They're calm in their manner and their response. They're respectful to the king or Nebuchadnezzar. They don't have a go at him. They don't argue. They are calm. You know, one of the ways you can commend your faith well in a faithless society is simply by living it out. By living it out faithfully. By being kind to those who oppose you. Loving to those who differ from you. Showing them through your actions what a Christian is. But they're not just faithful in their conduct, they're faithful in their convictions. Nebuchadnezzar is furious and he calls them in and gives them a second chance. They must have been quite good MPs for Nebuchadnezzar to give them a second chance, a second bite of the cherry, as it were. But they refuse. They say, we're not going to go along with you, Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, in verses 16 to 18, we see one of the greatest, I think, declarations of faith anywhere in the Old Testament. These guys are faithful to their convictions. They're faithful to God's power. Verse 16, they say this to Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we've no need to answer you in this manner. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he can deliver us out of your hand, O king. These men they're faithful to their convictions. They're faithful to God. They believe that God is sovereign. It reminds me of what Jesus said to Pilate when he was being tried. When Jesus said to him, you can have no power over me unless it was given you from above. They're saying to the great king of the world at the time, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the empire, the king of the world, God's the boss, not you. God's sovereign, not you. God does what he likes, not you. They trusted in God in the face of a burning fiery furnace. He can deliver us if he wants to. But they're also faithful to God's freedom. Verse 18, but if not, they believe that God is sovereign and that he has control over this world and over everything in it. But they do not presume that God will actually save them. They've got no confidence that God's going to deliver them from the fiery furnace, even though they know he can. They don't say, we're going to bind the fire, Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to claim deliverance in the name of God. They don't presume to know what God's purposes are. There's no name it, claim it theology here in the face of death. You know, one of the things about name it, claim it theology is it isn't faith in God, it's faith in your own plans and your own agenda. These guys don't do that. They are faithful to God's freedom. God can do what he likes. And God is not one to be manipulated. He's not one to be told what to do. He's someone to be obeyed and to be trusted. But they're also faithful to God's truth. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. See, they continue to trust God even if he doesn't come through for them. They're saying to Nebuchadnezzar, we believe that God is sovereign. He's the boss, not you. He can save us, but if he doesn't save us, we're still going to go on trusting him. We're still going to go on loving him. Because our trust and our love for God is not dependent on what God does, but on who God is. It's not dependent on what God does for us, it's dependent on who God is in himself. You know, sometimes people, and this happened to me a number of times, have said to me, you know, I used to believe and trust in God, but I prayed about this situation and God didn't come through. He didn't answer my prayer. So I stopped coming to church. I stopped believing. Or I used to believe and trust in God, but then this happened. And I prayed and I'd said, God, don't let this happen. I trusted and believed that it wouldn't. But it happened anyway. But real faith trusts God and loves God no matter what. It doesn't say to God, God, I will love you if you do this for me. Imagine if someone said that about you. You know, I'll be your friend. This happens in the playground at primary school. You know, I'll be your friend if you give me those sweets. I will love you if you do this for me. And do this for me. And do this for me. What would you think about somebody like that who only loved you because of what you did? You know, you say, well, why should I be your friend? And God would say, well, why should I be your God? You see, what they say is, even if you do not rescue us, God, even if you do not deliver us from this burning fiery furnace, we believe that you can rescue because you are a God who rescues and delivers. And so we are going to put our trust in you and you alone. See, these guys were fireproof before they went into the fire. Because what can a burning fiery furnace do to people with faith like that? I'm reminded of a story of a guy called John Chrysostom, who is the Archbishop of Constantinople back in the 5th century, and he was a bishop with a backbone. And he was brought before an empress who didn't really like him. And she said to John Chrysostom, if you carry on preaching and doing what you're doing, then I'll have to banish you to another country. And he said, well, you cannot banish me because this world is my father's house. And I'm in my father's house wherever I go. She said, but I will kill you. To which he replied, you cannot, because my life is hidden with Christ in God. So she said, well, I will drive you from your friends and you'll have no one left. To which he said, you cannot do that. For I have a friend in heaven from whom you can never separate me. There's nothing you can do to ultimately harm me. Fireproof. Courage. So how can you be a person like that? How can you be a faithful person in a faithless world? Where do you get that kind of courage from? Well, it comes from seeing and trusting in a divine deliverer. In verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar asks the all-important question of the chapter. He says this: "If you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who can deliver you out of my hands?" Who is the God who will deliver you? Who can do that? I am the boss. I am the king. Your God or me? Well, God answers the question. And he does so by doing three things. First of all, God does not deliver them from the fire. Verse 21, Nebuchadnezzar goes absolutely mad and he does this. "The three men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace." A fiery furnace which had been heated seven times hotter to match his emotions. He was furious with them, got them bound even in all the posh clothes that they would have worn before being brought to Nebuchadnezzar. They get tied up, they get thrown into that burning fiery furnace. And even though God could have saved them from it, he doesn't. Even though they believed that God could have saved them from it, he doesn't. Nebuchadnezzar has his way. He throws them into the fire. Fire in the Bible is a picture of suffering. Sometimes suffering in the Bible is referred to as fiery trials. You know, we can think as Christians that, well, if we're Christian, if we're believing in God, if we're trusting in Jesus, then God will deliver us from fiery trials, from times of suffering and times of difficulty. Especially when that suffering and difficulty is unjust and unwarranted. But this tells us that's not the case. You know, God never promises to deliver us from suffering and trials, from difficulties and problems. You know, if we think that he will do that, then we will be shocked when suffering happens to us, and it will happen to us. You know, one of the worst things that I think about suffering is the shock that it's happening to us. And it will be even more of a shock if you don't think that suffering comes to faithful believers. You know, suffering came to Jesus Christ, and he was the most faithful person who ever lived. Why should we think that we are exempted from it? Suffering is part and parcel of life, and we shouldn't be shocked when it happens to us, because God never promises to deliver us from suffering in this life. God doesn't deliver from the fire. But the second thing we see is that God does deliver in the fire. Nebuchadnezzar looks in the fire and he's astonished. In verse 24, he says this: "Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste, and he declared to his counselors, 'Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?' They answered and said to the king, 'True, O king.' He answered and said, 'But I see four men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods.'" He sees a fourth figure in the midst of the fire, and he describes him as a son of the gods. He describes him also as an angel. Who is this figure, mysterious figure who appears in the fire? Well, in the Old Testament, he appears many times, and he's often called the angel of the Lord. He appears at the burning bush, in the middle of the burning bush, when Moses meets with God on Mount Horeb. He appears to Moses, and Moses worships him. He appears to Joshua in Joshua chapter 5, just before the Battle of Jericho, and Joshua bows down and worships him. The angel of the Lord is a figure of God, because we should only worship God. And in fact, he's a figure of Jesus Christ, a pre-incarnate Christ. And so this angel who appears in the fire is God himself, a pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, appearing in the fiery furnace to deliver people. See, this is a picture of what Jesus Christ is going to do 600 years later when he goes into the ultimate fiery furnace, when he goes to the cross itself. You see, what is the cross? The cross is a fiery furnace. It's a fiery furnace not fueled by the anger of King Nebuchadnezzar for the disobedience of his subjects, but it's a fiery furnace fueled by the anger of God for the disobedience of men and women. People like you and me. People who have not obeyed God as we should, who've not lived as we should, who have done what we know we shouldn't have done and not done things that we know we should. See, the cross is the fiery furnace that Jesus himself went into to take upon himself the anger of God for our sin, being punished in our place so that he might get what we deserve, our judgment. And we, in turn, might be free of condemnation. He was consumed by the flames of God's anger so that you and I might never be consumed. That we might instead be ransomed, healed, restored, and forgiven. See, God delivers in the fire, not from the fire, but he also delivers through the fire. See, what happens to these men in the middle of this fire? The first thing that happens to them is that they are unbound. Their chains go in, verse 25. The fire causes them to lose their chains. Isn't that what happens when you go through times of difficulty and suffering in your life? Things that used to hold you back don't do so anymore. You begin to change. You begin to grow as a person. You begin to change and grow in your faith and trust in God. You see, that's what suffering does to us. It changes us. It makes us more like Jesus Christ. You begin to understand yourself better. You begin to understand life better. You become wiser. You begin to, the things that you used to hold on to, you hold on to less. Sometimes they're taken off you in the middle of suffering. That's what suffering is, isn't it? It's taken away from you things that you love so much. Suffering changes you. Suffering makes you more compassionate towards others who suffer and are in difficulty. See, in the middle of suffering, these people are released. That's what suffering is supposed to do to us. See, it's through suffering that grace and glory come into our lives. And they will come into your life through suffering if you trust Jesus Christ in the middle of it. If you hold on to him in the middle of suffering, then you will see that he is holding on to you. When three fiery trials, our pathway shall lie. His grace, all sufficient, will be your supply. The flame will not hurt you. His only design, your dross to consume and your gold to refine. See, that's what fire does. Fire refines gold. Pressure forms diamonds. And you'll be refined and you will be formed through your suffering if you trust God in the middle of it. But it's in the middle of suffering as well that they experience a closeness of walk with God. I'm sure they never ever walked with God again in their life as closely as they walked with him in the midst of this fire. Walking with God himself. Where? In the worst thing that ever happened to them. The fiery furnace. See, it's in the fire that you experience the presence of God. Reminds me of Mark chapter 6 when Jesus walks across the Sea of Galilee whilst his disciples are in the middle of the storm. See, it's in the storm that God comes close to you and walks beside you. It's in the fire of suffering that God comes alongside you and supports you and upholds you. It's not when you're lying on the beach in Spain. I don't know anybody who's led on a beach in Spain and said to me afterwards, it was there that I really experienced the presence of God as I was getting some rays of sunshine. But we find God in our loneliness, in our pain, in our betrayal, in our loss. You know, he exposes us to suffering and to difficulty and keeps us through suffering and difficulty and through fires and through storms and through operating rooms and through funerals and through an empty house. It's there that we meet with God. But finally, we also see that these men came through unhurt, unharmed. In fact, they came through promoted at the end of the chapter. See, what does the fire do to them ultimately? They, apart from losing their chains, they lose nothing. And through the fire, they get promoted, exalted. It's through suffering and through danger and through trials and through difficulties that God will lead us until he brings us safely home to himself in heaven. See, God doesn't save us from the fire, but he saves us in the fire and through the fire. And so Nebuchadnezzar answers his own question at the end of this chapter. Who is it, the God who will save you from my hand? The God of heaven and earth. Jesus Christ himself is the God who can do this, who will do this. And you can experience that if you put your trust in him. You see, all of us are going to have to go through suffering in our lives. Maybe you're going through a time of suffering at the moment. Maybe you're experiencing a fiery furnace like you've never experienced in your life. But if you haven't, and if you aren't, then you will do one day. It's part and parcel of life, and we shouldn't be shocked by that. But the question for you and me this morning is this: who are you going to take into that time of suffering with you? What God are you going to take with you into your suffering? Will it be your friends and your family? They can't go in it with you. Will it be your goodness that you rely upon to try and prevent yourself from going into it? It's not going to work. Suffering happens to good people and bad people. Jesus Christ is the only God who can save you in suffering and who will bring you through to the other side. This is the God we need to put our trust in. This is the one we need to find our hope in. This is the God who you need to rest in. If you've never done that before, put your trust in Jesus Christ. He is the God who will never let you down. No matter what you go through, no matter where you go, no matter what fiery trial you experience, if you go in it with Jesus Christ, you will come out the other side, not only unharmed and unhurt, but a better person, and ultimately, you will make it to heaven and nothing will ever stop you. The soul that on Jesus has leaned for repose, he will not. He cannot desert to its foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, he'll never, nor never, nor never forsake. That's where you get the courage from, to live faithfully in a faithless world. Let me pray. Gracious Father, we need this courage to live faithfully. Grant us this courage by looking to you, the ultimate deliverer who has promised not to deliver us from the fire of suffering, but to deliver us in it and through it. Lord, help us to trust you now before we go through suffering. Help us to trust you when we're in the midst of it, and to give thanks to you that you will bring us ultimately through it and to our home with you in heaven. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.